This is Ranger Kidwell Ross, editor at World Sweeper. I'm speaking today with Michael Nawa. Michael is the director of operations for Custom Maintenance Services. They're located in Pennsylvania, and they are our September 2012 featured contractors. First off, Michael, congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
You know, I have known you for as long as I've been in sweeping, which is 1988, and I know that you initially started a firm called Industrial Grounds Maintenance, and I'll take that part of the story. You started that with your father, I know. He was the guy that had the money, and you had the expertise. You ended up running that with him through, as I recall, 2002, when you had differences of opinion of the direction the company should go, and then at that point you became involved with Custom Maintenance. The reason I wanted to take that portion of it is that you were chosen by me as being the recipients of our American Sweeper Magazine Award of Excellence in Power Sweeping. I believe it was 2004. You and your father were joint recipients of the award that year. So I thought it was about time that we checked in to see what had happened with you and, of course, with Judy. And I'll leave it to you to tell people how that worked out and just who Judy is, other than that taskmaster that's I know you work for.
Yeah. I'm not going to phrase it that way.
I guess I'll be in trouble when she hears me phrasing it that way too, don't you know?
Custom Maintenance is owned by Judy, my wife. It was started by her in 2000 prior to my leaving Industrial Grounds Maintenance. It was founded basically to do the things that Industrial Grounds Maintenance wasn't prepared to do at the time, whether it was window cleaning or painting over graffiti or interior work like replacing ceiling tiles and painting hand railings to light janitorial things. Industrial Grounds Maintenance, through my father's direction, was primarily a sweeping company. Whatever needed to be swept was swept. They weren't so much a maintenance company as a sweeping company. Judy started her company in 2000 to fill the need or the void that was left by Industrial Grounds Maintenance, having customers who wanted more than just sweeping, and my desire not to let them get away from me as a customer and go to another company that would provide more. So Judy started her company, and in 2002, I left Industrial Grounds Maintenance, sold my interest back to my dad, and joined Custom Maintenance Services full-time. Judy, having started it as a maintenance company, is still what drives the business today. Although sweeping is probably 80% of our revenue, it is the entry to all of the other work that we do. Being the sweeper is what puts us on the site, you know, every day for the most part, or even at three times a week, it's still three times more than the landscapers there, and sometimes 10 times more than the property managers there. So it's what gets us into our market. It's why Custom Maintenance Services is a shopping center maintenance company and not a sweeping company.
Well, you are absolutely a poster company for the idea of doing what the customer needs to have done that you can handle and anything in that regard that is possible for you to do. Talk about, if you would, a little bit about the initial entry into the sweeping industry. There really wasn't much of an industry, I know, back in 1976 when you bought your first sweeper. If you would portray what that sweeper was like, what the industry was like, and how that all came about.
The old technology.
That's right. You were one of the inventors of a parking lot sweeping company.
Well, I was certainly there in the beginning, I believe. I mean, I must say that in my market, Eastern and Central PA, I did not know of parking lot sweeping as a business when I started it. It was presented to me by somebody who was a subcontractor of ours as something to do. Our 1976 Schwartz, which had a label on the dash calling it a mini American, was a 2-yard round tank, no dump, had a hand winch, hand crank winch to put the head up and down, and outside controls on the Wisconsin 4-cylinder engine. It had two doors in the back, like a Dutch door arrangement. You could open them both to shovel out the truck, or you could open the top one just to throw a couple of trash bags in the back. It was on a half-ton Chevy pickup truck, and it was essentially zero frills. It was a very interesting way to begin a business. We ran that truck into the very early 80s, 80 or 81, maybe 82. Started to buy additional trucks from Schwartz and kept our relationship with them well into the early 2000s. So, probably a good 20-year relationship with that manufacturer. Along the way, we had acquired a company here and there, some of which ran Timco's, and usually they were run for a little while to see if we could adapt to those, but eventually they were traded in favor of a Schwartz, so you would have a standard manufacturer, standard-ish, I should say, parts, excellent service. So the early sweeping industry was, there was a need, but nothing to fulfill it. There was dirty shopping center parking lots, and the landscaper was picking it up, or the janitorial staff from inside was coming outside to pick up the litter. There was no environmental consequences of having a litter-filled parking lot. At that time, that wasn't a consideration. It was simply a desire to be clean and present a good first impression to the customers. And that was the early part of the industry. It was an extension of the inside janitorial program.
Let me comment on that, because although I don't share your early roots in the late 70s with sweeping, I got involved essentially 10 years later with developing the first newsletter for Power Sweeping, the SuperVet Quarterly, which was done for the Schwartz organization. At that time, the industry was really starting to mature to where parking lots were kept clean because managers could see the benefit of that. They could see the benefit of not having material tracked onto the floors where they'd have to refinish the floors more often. And there was kind of the heyday, I'd say, from mid-80s to maybe 2000 or so, kind of the heyday of parking lot sweeping as I've known it. Was there much competition? Was there much recognition by property managers that we'll get more business than the guy next door if we keep this cleaner? What was this? Give me a sense of that.
I think anybody who is professionally involved in developing retail space, anybody from the architect to the mall developer to the tenants who are going to be occupying a major mall or a strip mall, all of them, because of the nature of retail, have a very strong grounding or knowledge of the benefits of a clean environment. They certainly all wash their store windows. They all certainly vacuum their carpets. They all certainly do things like that are appropriate for the nature of being clean. And the clean parking lot was an extension of that desire to be clean. It's just in the early part. Yes, in the heydays, I'll give you the 15 years between 1985 and 2000 as being sort of the salad days of the industry. It was when things were really being developed in real estate. People had money to spend at the time. Consumers either had money or had the willingness to borrow money to spend money. Shopping centers were being developed at a tremendous pace, and keeping up with appearances was one of the goals of not so much the shopping center developer, because once he developed it and turned it over for management, he was essentially done with it. But people who managed these centers professionally and managed retail spaces professionally saw the desire to be clean, or had a good, strong desire to have it look the way they wanted it to look. I don't think that changed from the 60s and 70s to the 80s when things really took off. I just think in the early part of the industry, there wasn't anybody to do the work. There wasn't a professional parking lot only oriented contractor available. There were pavers and line stripers, certainly. There were landscapers and janitorial people, certainly. But in the early years of both Schwartz and Timco and anybody else who built sweepers, parking lots were not what they were after. People buying sweepers were sweeping streets. And so they were taking street sweepers onto parking lots. And, they weren't quite built for that. They weren't picking up anybody who's ever tried to sweep up Kleenexes and newspapers with a mobile can attest to the fact that a mobile, as an excellent machine as it is not great for litter. So they had to develop parking lot sweepers, and I think Timco and Schwartz were in the forefront of that. And as they got their businesses off the ground, I wandered along and thought this was a good way to start a career or start a business. And I believe I got in early enough that I watched the industry rise into its heyday, and I've also been unfortunate enough to be here long enough to watch it, you know, sink back into strictly a numbers game when people will ask you to sweep a Target parking lot for $20 or, you know, do a Rite Aid or a grocery store and have a ridiculous budget in mind because they understand the value of clean, but they just don't think it should cost so much. Meanwhile, my first Schwartz truck was, you know, brand new, probably $17,000. And now you can easily spend over $100,000 for a new Schwartz sweeper, easily, without even taking all the bells and whistles. And yet they expect us to be sweeping the parking lot for what amounts to the same amount of dollars as we were doing it in the 70s and 80s. But I've been here a long time, and I've watched it come up, and I've watched it become a commodity. I've watched it go back to the people who are the janitorial people and the landscapers who are hand-picking lots instead of strictly professional sweeping companies, which is what takes Custom Maintenance back to being a shopping center maintenance company and not a sweeping company. When the economy takes a downturn, we take a downturn, but we don't get buried by losing all of our work when people stop sweeping or drop from 7 days a week to five or from five to three or from three to one. Certainly our sales goes down, our revenue goes down, but that's not, sweeping is not the only way we generate revenue here. So it's enabled us to weather the storm.
Well, I know you are very much a practitioner of the belief system that I share with you and basically have learned from you probably to get started, which is that you should do everything you can for a customer. And as I've tell people, extol time and again, you know, why should somebody else do all of those other maintenance, especially exterior maintenance, that shopping centers and other customers need when you have the opportunity to be with them three times a week, five times a week, once a week, once a month? You know, why can't you then get that business, whether it's striping or seal coating or handling any other kind of maintenance, whether it's ceiling tile or cleanup when people move out or whatever it is, the pieces that can be handled, you've got a company that I know does that and does that successfully.
I agree. And I have, I have for many years told most people who would listen that I credit, you know, that thought being in my head comes directly from Harold Green at Chamberlain Contractors, who did a seminar years ago, many years ago, in the 90s, perhaps, in the early 90s, at a pavement maintenance exposition on being horizontally integrated with your customer. You can't, in this business, be vertically integrated. It makes no sense for if you're going to be a sweeping contractor to own the company that makes the sweepers. But to be horizontally integrated, if you're going to sweep the parking lot, then you should also be repairing the parking lot and painting the parking lot and standing the stop sign back up that got knocked down and painting over the graffiti that you just drove past in your parking lot sweeper. It was his theory on horizontal, or his seminar on horizontal integration, that really struck a chord with me, and went home from that seminar and that trade show and mentioned that to my dad and said, I think we should take this direction, and he said no. And that was the beginning of the, I guess what's now a legendary split between my dad and I on how to run a maintenance company. He wanted to be sweeping, and I wanted to be maintenance. And for a while, it worked. And when it didn't, we went our own ways and both wound up with successful companies. So although he passed away in 2004, his company is still running to this day. Very worthy competitors of mine, or I am a very worthy competitor of theirs. I'm never sure which is which, but certainly if I have to compete with somebody, it would be a group of people who are as dedicated to being professional about what they're doing as I am.
That makes it certainly a lot better when you have that in your marketplace rather than some of the other things that people cite so often.
And they're here, too.
And they're there, too. That's
Don't
right.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, those few people are here as well. Certainly not a fan of the show Mad Men. I do enjoy it from time to time. But my favorite expression about business comes from an episode of Mad Men when the guy was bemoaning the fact that somebody declares themselves my competition, and suddenly he and I are equals. I have a guy with in my market with one truck. I've got a guy with two trucks, and they tell my customers that they're my competition, and somehow my customer thinks that his one-truck company and my 18-truck company are the same. I don't know how they find the room for that kind of thought process. The guy sweeps. He cuts grass. For the four or five shopping centers he services, I am certain he does a good job, or we would be doing those four or five shopping centers. But I have an organization that sweeps 240 properties a day. He sweeps two or four a day. That does not make us equals. So those people are in the... Now, industrial grounds maintenance is probably in the same ballpark, and so are many other larger companies, and that does make us equals, or at least competitors. But we have the honorable professional people we compete against, and we have the less so that we compete against, and we are forced to compete against all of them because they will go to Target and sweep that lot for the $20 that I talked about earlier, and it will take them quite a while to realize they're not making any money. Or it'll take them quite a while to realize they're not making enough money to replace a truck or replace an engine or replace a driver or even hire a driver if they're doing it themselves. Those people will eventually winnow themselves out, and they always have. The problem is eventually. Eventually costs me money. Eventually costs the industry reputation. And I think that is a very difficult thing to sit through when you've been doing this, as I have for, I believe, 35 years is a good estimate of how long I've been doing this. And it is difficult to deal with the word eventually. The startups come, the startups go. And to run an organization of this size, to have, 18 sweepers on the road, to have a maintenance staff, an office staff of five people, sales staff, supervisors, does not lend itself to spending an hour on a Target parking lot or more for $20. It just isn't the economy that I can live with. So when the people who hire sweepers to go on those aforementioned parking lots run out of people who will do it for that, eventually they will come back to myself or another larger company who has a good handle on what their costs are and what their profit needs are, what their margins have to be, and they'll be back up to paying what the market rate should be paying, wherever your market is. Just because it's here, well, one price here doesn't mean it's the same price in Arizona or Arkansas. So for whatever the market price is, it will eventually rebound to the market price. But in the meantime, those of us who aren't doing it are watching our industry, if not our bottom lines, get hurt by the people that are doing that. So I have very strong feelings, and that's very difficult to keep a calm voice when we talk about how things like that come into the industry. I personally know several of my fellow contractors do not like the T500 or the towable sweepers because they give an entry point into a lower-priced contractor. Somebody with a pickup truck or a decent-sized station wagon or minivan can tow a T500 around and suddenly be in the sweeping business. But I've got five of these things, three of them in daily route service every day because it's in some of the rural areas of PA where you have a 30-minute drive between stops and stops that are generating $30, $40. Unless you want to cut that part out, it's difficult to make enough dollars in a night to support a $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 sweeper. But a guy with a T500 and a pickup truck can make a reasonable profit for his company with one of those. So I don't have any problem with those at all.
Well, and I've always felt and advised contractors that if you have a guy that has a T500 or T600, this is for those who don't know, this is a Victory Sweepers tow behind product. That does a great job for what it is. There's no air component, though. So one of the things that I believe can be done is a reputable contractor or a full-service contractor, let's say that, because you don't know who's going to be operating these things, that has an air sweeper. You need an air sweeper once a week, once every 2 weeks. You certainly need it once in a while, with great frequency on a parking lot, or you're going to be picking up the grit, and it's going to become ball bearings, and it's going to become tracked in, so that you have to refinish your floors. And you should, as a contractor that's full service, that is experienced, you know when to put what on your routes. And it seems to me that all you're doing is saying, recognizing that your market is now segmented. There are people who are willing to pay for the service as they should. They get a different level of service. There's some other folks, but all of them need some air sweeping once in a while, and you have that capability.
I agree. I agree completely. It's not something you can build. You know, having one or ten of those is not something you can build a company on. It is simply a usable tool to continue to enhance the rest of our business. That's exactly how we use them. How somebody else uses them is up to them, but I don't have any problem with them being in the marketplace at all. If we're going to compete with somebody, they don't even have to have that. They could have a pan and broom and a blower or a billy goat and suddenly declare themselves a sweeping company and be out there maintaining two Kmarts and a Walmart and maybe do just fine for themselves. I do not know, but that does not make them competition.
Well, and we have the featured contractor last month, and what a juxtaposition was the gentleman with Crown Maintenance in Des Moines, Iowa area, who's sweeping, quote unquote, without any sweepers. They're just hand picking, and yet, you know, that's called a sweeping company. So there's a lot of change that's certainly happening in the marketplace, and I chose them to feature because I wanted to start some communication conversation in the industry about that business model. You know, recognizing that guy is out there, he's doing the Walmarts and Kmarts in his area, hasn't lost any customers, and so forth. But it's a different level of service, and to recognize that if our market is going to segment out, then the established sweeping contractors need to not only do full-service maintenance and horizontal integration, which I think you are exactly in the right spot on, and why every sweeping contractor doesn't do that, I don't know. But the other side of that is to recognize that this market segmentation is taking place and provide for your customers. You have your operation is rolling, and so you can provide market segmentation of services to anybody at the same rate that somebody else can, if that's the service they want, hey, unless they don't, we've talked previously, if they don't recognize their costs, if they are underbidding because they don't recognize that a sweeper wears out and does it quickly, then you can't compete with them, just like you can't compete with anybody else that is, you know, in a loss leader situation. You hope they go away, and eventually they do, unfortunately, as one contractor told me with a kind of a wry smile at last year's NPE, they sell their beat-up old truck to somebody else who comes in and thinks, oh, I have a sweeper now, I can sweep, and he doesn't realize what he's into and how to price. So it's certainly there's these difficulties and emerging changes that are going on in our industry. And I think the question is, one of the central questions that we need to address as an industry is how do reputable sweeping contractors maintain, hold on, expand upon all of the levels of service that are being requested these days, because there's no need for somebody else to be able to come in and get that piece.
All right, I agree. And as a just a brief aside on the people that are hand-picking a parking lot, we have somebody who's really not a competitor of ours. They maintain two shopping centers in my market, both for the same owner. The two shopping centers share the same owner. That's all the work they do, those two shopping centers. They have a Timco 210. I've seen it maybe once in the last 2 years. They don't use it because it's expensive to run, they say. They don't take it out in the rain. They do, you know. But I have breakfast with my wife probably more than two times a week at the restaurant that's in the shopping center, and it's a large shopping center. Probably 280,000, 310,000 square feet, with several major national anchors, including Target. And that property is completely hand-picked. There's no sweeper goes through there, maybe not for weeks at a time. And I have yet to find a flaw in the way the property looks. I eat there, I buy gas there, I drive around and look, because I'm always looking for an opening to get into that property, because I really would like to have it. But the people that are doing it are doing a really good job. I know nothing about the economy of it. I don't know what they get paid. I don't know, what they're paying their people. I don't know anything. All I know is they're handpicking the lot, and the place looks tremendous. So you can run that. The business model is not going to determine your professionalism. The equipment level you carry is not going to determine your professionalism. I'm sure there are people who are at my size or even bigger that have a five-night-a-week contract who are only doing it four, or have a three-night-a-week contract who are only going once. Or, it was my sad day to be on a job with one of our paving companies, and we were seal coating and line striping, and we watched the sweeper come through. We were outside of Philadelphia, and it had New Jersey plates, and it came through the lot. The guy never even put the head down, and if he had, it wouldn't have done any good. There were no side plates on the head. There were no flaps on the head. He drove around hand-picking the lot, and I asked him. He never even started the pony motor, and I did stop him and ask him how things were going. That's an interesting truck. What's that? What does that do? And the reason he was driving around the lot is because the truck had a GPS unit in it, and they were being tracked, and that's how they told the customer that they were there. But I mean, the truck shouldn't even have had a head on it. It was a rusted, worthless piece of crap that was just four wheels and an engine to drive a GPS unit around.
Yeah. And so how sad is that?
It was sad. I mean, it's an industry that I feel that I've contributed a great deal to. It was heartbreaking to watch that happen. It was in a market that I don't serve. I don't, certainly I would not be sweeping in the Philadelphia market. It has no interest to me. I don't know who the truck belonged to. It wasn't lettered. So I can't make any, I can't throw a stone at somebody in particular. Nor I don't think I would by name if I knew who struck it was, but it was just the saddest thing to see that there are people out there who will still do that. And is that the result of taking that job for $20? I have no idea. I never bothered to ask the property manager whose property were on how much he was paying the sweeper. It was so gut-wrenchingly sad to me that I just let the whole thing go. It's none of my business.
Well,
as an industry leader, it's my business.
That's right.
Which is why I bring it up now. But to go to the property manager and say, you're not getting what you're paying for, really, it was not my place. The property manager was on site. It was not a remotely managed property. The person who managed the property was on site all the time. Every time I was there for the job the paving company was doing, the manager was there. He knew what he was getting. He accepted what he was getting, which tells me it was a price-based decision, not a quality-based decision. You juxtapose that with the people who are handpicking the parking lot where I eat breakfast, and it's not the same thing. The guy's paying for sweeping and getting handpicking. The other, the one where I eat breakfast, they're paying for handpicking, they're getting handpicking, or they're paying for clean, regardless of how they're getting it. And it is clean. It is spotless. This other property was, not so much so.
Well, and I am sorry to report that I heard several contractors at this last year's National Pavement Expo, and there was widespread complaint about the low prices being mandated by third-party vendors such as the, U.S. Maintenance and Springwise and others of the world. And they were just shaking their heads, but kind of agreeing that, you just bid on doing it five nights a week or seven nights a week. You could only show up two or three nights a week, and that's just how it was. And so the only way they could do it for these low prices was just basically not to show up, or they'd just drive through the parking lot and look around and see if there's any. They'd pick up the big stuff. Is there a box or some big stuff laying around?
When you do that, we are very clear. So, we do work for several, probably half a dozen, third-party providers. Some we have, I think we have good working relationships with almost all of them. Some of them are better payers than others, as is the case. But some of those six are just exemplary partners to work with in this business. Exemplary. They don't give you something that they know you can't. They don't even take the work of, you know, for somebody who they want to sweep for $20, $25, $30. I mean, we don't get that kind of stuff from them. And some of them are less so. Some of them, I mean, everybody knows about the U.S. Maintenance Walmart debacle. You know, but in my opinion, that was as much Walmart's fault as it was U.S. Maintenance's fault. U.S. Maintenance apparently promised something they couldn't provide. They wanted to, but they just didn't realize what the market was going to do. And Walmart should have known. You cannot have that many stores, and which is over, what, 4,000, and get the same price everywhere. It just, that's ridiculous. It's, you know, so it's as much the customer's fault as it is the third-party person who sold it to them's fault. I agree with the people at the payment show, which, you know, no disrespect to Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, the NPE is the greatest show on earth. Been there every year. I've only missed two in my entire career. What you learn there is extraordinary. What you hear on the show floor and in the hotel lobbies and at the places of adult libation are unfiltered truth about the industry and about the state of the industry that we're in. Many people believe that third-party management of exterior facilities is the scourge of the earth. And the way some of the third-party managers have managed those third-party services, they have made it the scourge of the earth. I am not my customer, so I don't always understand why my customer buys what he buys the way he buys it. Certainly if you are the top maintenance person at a national retail chain, you know that every store buys snow plowing, line striping, you know, and maybe to make your job easier, you want to sub that stuff out or farm that out to a third-party management company rather than have your own in-house staff do it. But you know that what you've been paying all these years, and to allow somebody to come into your office and tell you that you can reduce that price by X amount of dollars, or to accept the premise that this person through volume pricing can lower your prices every year from now on, is ridiculous. If that was true, third-party management people would be managing my insurance policy and my insurance rates would go down every year. But that doesn't happen, and neither can they follow through on their promises of the same. So it's
more in the same category of and the person that will be bringing you these wonderful benefits is named Santa Claus.
Cool. Well, the thing is, all they do is get between me and my customer. And now there's another profit center. Their profit center is between me and my customer. I have customers for whom I do an entire portfolio. I have customers for whom I do a good portion of a portfolio. I have some customers that I, you know, are a huge company that I am privileged to do 5 or 6% of their portfolio, and that's still an awful lot of shopping centers for me. They are not looking for one person to do all several hundred shopping centers. They understand that all that person is doing is getting another profit center between them and their provider, and they prefer to keep a nice strong hand on their provider because they certainly keep a nice strong hand on me.
Well, and they can that way too, and you know, they're commanding a price or willing to pay a price that you know, allows them to do that. But in my experience through the years, anecdotally, it appears that the people who pay the least are also the fussiest. They have the most complaints. You know, it's the 80-20-20-80 rule. And so
But I don't. Yes, I agree with the premise, but the cause of that is they're paying the least. They're
exactly. The least. Right.
They're getting the least amount of services possible.
And then you're getting, yeah, the provider then has to provide the least amount of service because that's all they're getting paid to do.
Yeah.
They're probably providing a little more than they should anyway, and then it's still not enough because the price is too low. And, well, we could go on to that forever. Let's talk about the solution. How do you market a full-service organization today when some of it is third-party vendored, some of it is not? You come into a – let's take the third-party vendor first. You have a group of stores that you have bid on through a third-party vendor for the sweeping portion and maybe something else there too, and then and then what? It strikes me that you're in a better position to do that than a non-full-service contractor because you can bid on the sweeping, and if you broke even, you'd be okay if you are also putting up their stop signs, striping their parking lots, fixing the potholes, and so forth. So
I could be wrong. Generally, I'm not. But I could be wrong. We don't market at all to third-party providers. Not at all. We have one or two that we work with that are they're happy with us. We're very happy with them. And we encourage them to ask us to price line striping for the portfolio of things that we're doing for them. We have one that handles many, many grocery stores. We have one that handles many, many home improvement centers. And we would be happy to be providing other services for those two groups of clients and encourage them to ask us. But I don't know what their relationship is with their customer, what they're being required to do or what they're being asked to put bids in on. But we make it very clear to them, we hope, we've made it very clear to them, that if they get bids for striping or asphalt patching or other types of things, that we would love to be involved in that process. When it comes to the third-party management people that are managing many, many drugstores, or other small properties, we don't market to them at all. They generally have marketed a single service to a large group of drugstores or a drugstore chain, and that's what they do. If they market sweeping, they just market sweeping. You know, if they market sweeping and landscaping, they market the two of them as are considered. As the trades are considered in the industry, sweeping and landscaping, snow plowing is another thing. But nowhere does the stop sign that fell down fall into their thinking because it's not something that's done at every property every week. They're not built to take advantage of those small emergency situations. So we don't market to those people. We recently just finished our program of having engaged a marketing consultancy company. And one of the things that came out of that, there's two ways to market things. There are the farmers and there are the hunters and gatherers. And we are the kind of company that we use the farming method. We build relationships with people. In the early, late 70s, the first customer I ever had is still my customer today. The company is still my customer. The first plaza that I ever swept for anybody, industrial grounds maintenance, is still doing. So that customer is, and that plaza is, you know, 30 years old and still is a customer of ours. Now, I cannot recall whether they've come and gone with other providers in the meantime. I think not. But we build relationships with people. We build, early on in our career, we started with Leo Eisenberg, which is where that shopping center came from, the one I previously referenced. And like most shopping center developers, they don't develop just one shopping center. They don't build just one, and that's the end of their business. Their business is building shopping centers, developing real estate, and that's what they continue to do. So we built a relationship with Mr. Eisenberg and with his local staff, and for a long time, they would build something in in our geographic area, and we would put a bid in, and we were the known quantity because we did, you know, when they built their second, we were doing their first. When they built their fifth, we were doing the first, second, third, and fourth, so they could look at any of the other properties they own and see an excellent reference for what we were going to be able to provide the next one. And we were almost always, if it was in our area, we were almost always awarded those shopping centers. Same thing applies today. I have a one property owner, which is there's a property owner, a partner, and a property manager. There's three people in the company. We maintained, put a bid in on the one they built near our office. Have maintained it for a year or so, and they asked us about additional properties. And now we have four of their five properties that we take care of for them. And it has been an excellent relationship. It has been, you know, like every relationship, it has its ups and downs. It has its mistakes that we've made and errors that they've committed. But when you build a relationship on service and value and trust, you don't get kicked out the first time you make a mistake. They understand that mistakes happen because this is a relationship. If you are the person who is doing it for price only and you don't make a mistake, but you get they get a $2 per suite lower bid, you're out the door because it's based on price. That has happened to us as well. A company we simply won't work for any longer gave us a contract, awarded us a contract, a one-year contract to maintain a shopping center. After our third or fourth day of service, they called us and said that they had gotten a lower price on the property and we were free to match it or they were going to terminate our contract. And we said, okay, terminate our contract. You know, you gave us a contract for a year. You went through the bidding process, you closed the bids, you awarded us the contract, and now 3 days later, you say you got a lower price. And, you know, we had one remaining shopping center with that company. We opted not to bid on it when it came up for bids again for this year, for August through August, July of next year. Opted not to bid on it. Before the end of the period, the property manager called and informed my secretary that he had gotten three bids. All of them were lower than ours. And if we wanted to match that bid, we could keep sweeping. And I told her, no, please say no. But, you know, everybody in here understood we didn't put in a bid. So he didn't have three bids that were lower than ours because, quite frankly, there's not three people around here who would sweep that plaza.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wouldn't be three if it was including me. So to say he had three prices that were lower than ours, we let him sweep that plaza. We let it go because it was the same company that did the previous action I just described to us, and we just decided not to do business with them anymore.
Well, I think that's a place where let me jump in here for a second. Is I'm not sure we've discussed that in one of our featured podcasts before, but that is the, you know, the modus operandi of the property manager who, no matter what your bid is, Or say picks the low bid and then says, you know, we've got something that's lower. I'm a longtime garage sale kind of guy, and one of the guys that I go out with all the time, his technique is to, and he uses this all the time, and it's very successful. But be careful when it's being used on you. And what he says is, he looks at the item. Let's say it's $20, and he says, well, what's the lease price you'd take on this? And the seller, you know, might think, he says, well, 15, I'd take 15. And now he's told you the least price he'd take on it. And what my friend will come back and say is, well, I was thinking more about 10. And sometimes he gets it for 10, sometimes he gets it for $12.50. And the point here is that, you'll have a variety of things that can be used on you as a contractor that aren't necessarily true, and, you know, that could just well be what that, especially if you don't have a relationship with them, that's what they're doing, is they get low bids, and then they'll call each contractor back and say, well, you know, we've got a bid that is really $5 a sweep lower than any of the bids they've gotten. Can you match it? Well, if you've given your best price and you haven't included a windfall profit, and you've included your necessary profit to stay in operation and to meet your expenses and to hit your target goals, you really can't do that because you've already done it. You've given them your least cost bid. So, you know, think about that because, you know, my guess is that there are contractors out there that are being played, and they will, in fact, say, oh, well, okay, it's only $6 a sweep less, and we get the contract. And, you know, that they also don't get to stay in business.
I am an absolute believer in what you just said. There's no doubt in my mind that that goes on every day. And it's the games that they play that you can either participate in or not participate in. There's just... everybody wants what they want. That guy's job is to get the best service at the lowest price. And it will depend on whether he wants the best service at the lowest price or whether he wants the lowest price and will take whatever service he can get. You just don't know. And there have been many times recently when we have been asked to bid on a shopping center, whether it's new construction or, you know, whatever, and I have instructed the people that work for me, and I do it myself. My first question is, well, tell me a little bit about your budget. What is it that you're looking to do here? You know, I want to ascertain that if they have a, you know, a Class A half-million square foot, strip mall or, you know, power center with six national tenants as anchors, and they want to stop spending $120,000 a year for sweeping and want to spend $91,000 for sweeping, well, then we can talk. If they want to, if they have a 46,000 square foot Turkey Hill or 7-Eleven anchored center and they want to stop spending $8 a sweep and start spending $4 a sweep, well, then I'm not interested. I can't do that. So the first thing we try to ascertain is what is the budget for this job? It doesn't hurt to ask. It's probably, in my opinion, one of the most responsible questions you can ask because they need to know, you know, I'm not going to waste my time or the time of my staff on a blind bid that for which you know nothing. Just do this. Give me a price on sweeping this property 7 days a week. You know, okay, well, who empties the trash cans? You know, is there a dumpster on site for trash cans? Who does the sidewalks? I mean, is that a part of, you know, because sometimes you get a scope of work that says they want you to sweep the parking lot 7 days a week. They don't, there's nothing else included. I don't really want to have that job. I'll take it. I mean, I have some of them here. I've got plenty of those here. But that's not the job I want. The job I want is the one where I can build a relationship with the property manager, build a relationship with hopefully the property owner, build a relationship with some of the tenants or the maintenance people for some of the tenants, and do what the shopping center needs, which is keep it clean, keep it painted, watch after the graffiti. If I'm not doing the landscaping, make sure the landscaper is doing his job and not mowing the grass in such a way that he blows all the grass into the parking lot, which now lays up against the curb and creates a problem for the sweeper. We all face that. But I want those properties where there is an involvement between my company and the people who run or own the company. That is just the heavenly scenario. That's the one that works out best, quite frankly, for everybody, because the customer knows he has a contractor who's engaged in what he's trying to do. I have customers who, when the economic downturn really took a squeeze a year or two or three ago, I had customers who sent me a letter saying, we are retroactively lowering the price of your contract by 20%, and you can either accept this reduction or we're going to put the plazas out for bid. And I sent them a very nice typed letter back, please put the shopping centers out for bid. I do not accept this reduction. One of my competitors accepted the reduction. He was a snow plower on one of the centers that I was not in the package but was owned by the same company. He got the same letter and asked my advice, and I said, don't do it. He did it anyway. I did not. They rebid the plazas, and I got all but one back at my original price. I did not accept it. I let them put it out for bids, and they understood that the market wouldn't bear that kind of reduction. But the fact that they just sent a letter out, you know, I have a company on the opposite end of the spectrum where I do 24 shopping centers for. I got a call personally, a phone call from the president of the company, who I've never heard from before, dealing with director of property management, dealing with property managers, dealing with development people. Never have I heard from the president of the company. She asked me on the phone if I could take a 5% reduction in my prices for 1 year, just 1 year, and then they would return the contracts to their previous price. I said, absolutely, without hesitation. I don't know what I'd have said if she had said 20 or asked for 20, but she asked for 5, she asked for it in person, and she introduced herself as the person running the company. You can't have a better customer than that. You can have a much better customer than the first example, but not better than the second example. Those are people you would do almost anything to help out, because what you're building is loyalty. There's a sign that I used to have. I don't know where I acquired it. I don't know who told me it. But he used to say, customer satisfaction is nothing. Customer loyalty is everything. Because if you build a customer, a relationship with a customer, and you don't get there tonight, he will forgive you that as long as you get there tomorrow night. If you don't have that relationship with that customer and it's just a price-based thing and you don't go tonight, he thinks you're screwing him. He doesn't think you're coming back tomorrow night to make it up. He just thinks you didn't go. And those are the kinds of things, and those are the kinds of property managers and situations we seek very strongly to avoid.
Well, it's easy to listen to this, and, of course, you and I have been around each other a long time, but it's easy to understand why you're one of the voices that is so well-respected at the National Pavement Expo and elsewhere in the sweeping industry. What do you do in terms of rising prices, fuel surcharges, or insurance, if insurance went up radically, that sort of thing? How do you break that kind of news to your existing customers who are under long-term contracts?
Well, we are in a position where we honor our contracts. We do have a breakout clause in most of our contracts if diesel fuel hits $5 a gallon. Then our prices are no longer, I mean, the contract is no longer valid. We cannot sustain that. The decision was made here when we first started that we were not going to charge a fuel surcharge because they never go away. I have a dumpster company that I pay a dumpster at one of our shopping centers. It's $425 a month. The fuel surcharge is $82. $82, 20%.
That's amazing.
Of the dumpster cost is the price of the dumpster is fuel surcharge. I understand a couple years ago it was $2, and now it's $4. But it doesn't take $82 more of fuel to come to that shopping center and dump that dumpster the once a week you're there. That's just not, and that's why fuel surcharges don't work. When we had a rash of price increases here, we went through our fuel bills. We determined, I mean, we buy 8,000 gallons of diesel fuel a month here. And it's easy to see that a dollar rise in price is $100,000 a year additional expense for us. We went through our contracts several years ago when we did a major realignment of our contracts and our pricing. We divided our fuel costs, our fuel usage and fuel costs by the number of hours we were running our sweepers. And in most cases, the prices of the time on site literally went up $2.40 to not more than $5 per sweep, because it was an extra $2 per gallon, but on most places you're burning 2 gallons of diesel fuel. So it's an extra $4. I got my extra $4, and because the original $62 was profitable, I didn't need to make it $10. I needed to make it what it was. Now, that was, I believe, happened when fuel was at like 320. Diesel was at 3 or 325. It's now at $4. Our next alignment won't happen until we hit $5 a gallon. So we absorb a great deal of that fuel cost increase. Unlike every one of our subcontractors, dumpster companies, you know, the cost of trash bags goes up when fuel goes up. And when you buy, you know, 40 or 50 cases of trash bags at a time, a $2 increase in a case of trash bags is a lot. It's a significant amount of money. So it's how we handle it is we honor our contracts. We price them. You know, we get multiple-year contracts. I have 1, 3, and 5-year contracts here. The 5-year contracts are priced where I think things are going to be in 3 years, so that I don't get, you know, buried at the end of the contract. And again, in Pennsylvania, I don't know where anybody else is, but in Pennsylvania, any contract is cancelable upon 30 days' notice by either party. So if I've made a mistake and I'm in over my head and I'm, you know, I cancel the contract. I have terminated 3 or 4 customers just this year because they were not the customers we were seeking to have. One notorious one, our salesperson sold us a project at a shopping center, which was interior maintenance, exterior maintenance, landscaping. But the budget just wasn't enough. But they had other shopping centers. And we build a relationship with this person, and we can get those other shopping centers and bring this one up into, you know, what the market price is. And we worked there for a year and a half, 6 months over our initial one-year contract. Never got a single piece of work from any of the other shopping centers. And I just said, that's enough. I'm not spending all this time for this budget. I sent the property manager a letter and, you know, gave her 30 days notice, and we were done. Not a question why, not a peep.
Well, that's a good point of the times when you can afford to be on a lesser margin when you have expectations of the future. That makes perfect sense. Talk about tracking, you know, whether that's GPS or what you do to track and make sure that your customers are getting what they expect and that you're getting from your personnel what you expect.
Our fleet is tracked with a product or a program called NextTrack. I don't have a lot of information about it. I'm sure they're on Google, NextTrack. They are live GPS units installed in the trucks, so I know where the trucks are. Prior to that, we had employees with iPhones, and we used an AT&T product to track the phone. The problem with that is I would find out where my employees were, not where my trucks were. So when they were not at work, there was no way to turn the system off and, you know, not know that they were at the movies or they were over here or they were over there, which I didn't want to know. I don't want to know where my employee is. I want to know where my truck is. So we switched from that, and that system was defeatable by uninstalling it from the iPhone and then reinstalling it, you know, some other time. So it was not what we were really looking for. There were some report issues and things like that, but it wasn't what we were looking for. The NextTrack program, it's installed in the truck. It's live. It pings in two-minute intervals, and we can drill down onto a shopping center. And when we get a call that says, you guys haven't been here in a week, I can take my iPad over to the front desk of whatever person said that. I can log on to NextTrack, and I can say, okay, here's the breadcrumb trail for the truck that serviced your property last night. And it shows the little dots of every part of the shopping center he was on. And it shows in the data log that he arrived on site at, you know, 12:57 and 10 seconds, and he left at 1:28 and 57 seconds. I mean, it's down to that increment of time. We do it for two reasons. One, to protect our drivers. The driver is defenseless against a claim that we haven't been there for a week when all we're doing is filling out say again? No. See, here's a perfect example. We had a shopping center that we sweep once a week, had a store in it that the owner of the store had his father watching the store and had his father close up the store at the end of the night, the father came out of the store, lifted up the curbside trash receptacle and put the ring of keys under the sidewalk trash receptacle Saturday night. And I got a call from my director of operations that said, hey, I got a call from this tenant that, did we sweep the lot at this shopping center? Because it looks like the lot was swept and the trash can's emptied and the keys are missing. And I said, well, you know, on that route, we have one truck out. And we looked up the driver's GPS breadcrumb trail, and he wasn't anywhere near that shopping center. He was on his regular route, about where we would have expected him to be. And it showed him leaving the office. And that shopping center swept on Sunday as part of our schedule, not on Saturday. So we could show definitively that it was Saturday night. We were not there. I mean, if you don't believe me there, I can show you every truck that was in motion on Saturday night, and not any of them were near that shopping center. So it was simply became a case of somebody saw him put the keys under there. And why the trash can was empty, couldn't tell you. Maybe it wasn't really empty. And why the lot looked like it was swept, maybe they were just, you know, hoping that we had picked up the keys. But we were able to prove definitively that we did not stop there for any reason, and those keys weren't taken by us.
Yeah, makes very good sense. How about routing? Do you use any product for routing, or how does that work there?
Fortunately or unfortunately, what I use for routing is in my head, having done this for a long time, servicing the market that I service, the routing is done based on what I know of the geography of where my stops are, and you know it's done by me. It's done by some of my staff as well to make the best sense of things. But there are no products we use, no software things that we use. Nextrack has a routing component, but it does not generate a conflict alert. We recently discovered that we had two shopping centers across the street from each other that were being done by two different trucks. And I don't know why it took the supervisor a while to realize that, but one day we were sitting down looking at the paperwork, and on paper it doesn't say what the shopping center across the street is on that run sheet. But for some reason we had them all listed as on one piece of paper or one screen, and I said, why is this guy doing this center and this guy doing this center? And the logistics person said, why? I said, because they're across the street from each other. And nobody knew that. When you don't get out in the market, when you're doing this from the office, when you're, the drivers knew what was going on, but the drivers never thought to say anything about it. They thought we knew what we were doing. And God bless them. I certainly
appreciate it. Nice vote of confidence.
You know.
in the face of lack of reality in this case.
Yeah, but in reality, it would be nice if they would see that as a conflict, like we would see that as a conflict. I mean, it turns out that it was, it wasn't horrible because one truck was coming from the east and that was his turnaround point. The other truck was coming from the west and that was his turnaround point to go back to his office. But one of the two trucks wouldn't have had to drive all the way to the middle. They could have stopped short, let the other guy handle the one across the street and go back, or they could have switched nights, or there's always a better way to do it. Routing is something that you must constantly tweak. You have to constantly be aware of, and I don't know that routing software would do this for you. So, Walmart's require being done between midnight and 6. Targets require being done between 4 and 6. There's other people that have other time frames, and then there's the municipal requirements for noise and white bars and some just outright bans on sweeping after, after 9 o'clock, period, no matter how much noise you don't make. You have to take all those things into consideration, and routing software won't do that. So we don't use any kind of routing software at all. It's all basically experience and having a good crew of drivers.
Well, let's go back to fuel for a minute. Do you buy fuel from the same vendor? Do you have it bid? How does that work?
Well, for the most part, each of the offices, there are 6 remote offices, 6 satellite offices, have the place where they prefer to buy their fuel. And it's not always by how low the price is. It's mostly by how good the coffee is. We have a convenience store chain local to us that has a 3-cent per gallon discount card. And if you buy stuff inside the store, you say you build up points to get a free sub or a free sandwich or a free coffee or a free Coke or, you know, whatever. But if you use it outside at the gas pump, you, in order to entice you to have it, they save you 3 cents a gallon. We had everybody get one. It's your card. You get all the points. You know, we don't get the free sub. You get the free sub. And I get to save 3 cents a gallon on gas or on diesel fuel. Well, on any product, actually. So we really encouraged that. And when we brought it up to our employees, we found out that most of them already had one because they want to save 3 cents on the gas coming to work, just like we want to save the 3 cents on diesel when they're out working. We don't act, you know, because we serve it. We're in so many towns geographically. We're so geographically widespread. It doesn't make sense for us at the central office or main office to try to dictate where they're buying fuel. We just try to tell them to get the best deal they can. And I cannot say that I am going to object to the fact that they pay 2 cents more a gallon for diesel fuel because the place has a lot better coffee or has a Dunkin' Donuts in it than, you know, saving a couple of extra bucks, or, you know, because it wouldn't be a couple extra bucks, and getting a place, going to a place with crappy coffee or something that's going to cause them other problems, you know, like a bad part of town or, you know, going to a truck stop and trying to fill up your sweeper with a, you know, a nozzle that's 2 inches in diameter that's made for filling up tractor trailers. You know, that doesn't work well in most sweeper fuel systems. You're trying to get the fuel into the tank.
Well, that's a nice generality to bring up because you really do have to consider your employees and their welfare and well-being and so forth too. That's you know, jumping over dollars to save pennies or nickels kind of thing. Do you use aftermarket parts or do you use genuine sweeper parts made from the genuine manufacturer of those parts, or how does that work for you?
Well, there's no such thing in general unless it's a jig welded or fixture welded weldment. There's no such thing as an original sweeper part. The bearings that, you know, the shaft bearings that come on my Schwartz SuperVac sweepers are MP27 inch and 11/16 bearings. You know, whether they're manufactured by or sold by Kamen or Applied Industrial Technology or whoever, Schwartz didn't build those bearings in order to put them on the trucks. They bought those bearings just like I do. So I do not buy my brooms or bearings or anything of the sort from Schwartz. I do not buy my fans from anybody but who builds them originally. But the rest of the, you know, the updraft hose, you know, RW Connection or a vendor like that, which is a rubber goods vendor, is near-ish to us and can sell me a 50-foot section of 10-foot intake, 10-inch intake hose, and cut it into the appropriate lengths. And I pay the same price per foot, so I can drive over there and put 25 2-foot sections in my truck and drive them back to the shop and distribute them from there to whoever needs them and save a reasonable amount of money. I can't give you a price, but if they're priced at dollars per foot, I'm probably paying 15-20% less than getting it from Schwartz. I tried to buy a hydraulic part recently from Schwartz, one of the valve bodies, and it was $389 from Schwartz. And I was a little taken aback by that because it was not that large a part, although I understand machined things are not cheap. Went down to the local hydraulic shop and acquired one after they had to order it, acquired one for $159. Schwartz is buying it just like everybody else is buying it. They're in the business to stock that stuff and build their trucks with it and mark it up as parts. And, I certainly respect that they need to be able to do that. But I'm buying the same things they're putting on their trucks, and I'm buying them locally. I'm sourcing them locally at my local industrial bearing dealer, at the local rubber goods dealer for the hose, at the power transmission place for the belt, the drive belt. But we have our heads, our sweeping heads, made locally at a local weld shop.
And I have no problem with that, but I would not let them make a fan, for example. If you're going to make a fan, I would really rather you be the guy who builds them all day long for Schwartz or Victory or whatever, knows how to balance it, knows how to weld it so it doesn't come apart the first time you use it, or the 50th time you use it, or for us, the 500th time you use it. I don't want to come in apart at all. So I would not want to have something like that, the critical part, be other than something from the original manufacturer. Drag shoes I buy from an aftermarket vendor who I believe the manufacturers are getting them from as well.
Well, that's part of it, is that the recognition that the manufacturers are buying from somebody, you know, most of this. And you can find out that information when you talk to a third-party vendor and see who, if anybody that they sell to that are manufacturers, and compare. Tracking is so important, you know, track the wear time that you get from the different parts made by different people and see what your value is. It might even be that a part that wears less but with considerably less money, you know, might be a better value, as long as you add in the labor that it took to put it on and take it off and that sort of thing, too. What else? You know, we've talked about a variety of things here, and this interview is longer than most just because of your expertise and experience in the industry, and I knew you'd have more than most to be able to say. What else do you think should be said in this interview, and perhaps we can move toward the future, you know, your expectations of the future, or any other component of running your operation that you haven't really touched on yet?
Wow, that's an entire book, probably. Whatever you choose to do, you should do it professionally. You should approach it professionally. A long time ago, I was told and took to heart that professionalism isn't what you do, it's the attitude with which you do what you do. You know, even a school janitor can be professional in what he does. And we all know that the professional Wall Street people can be less than professional in what they do, not to pick on a particular industry. But it's about how you do what you do, not what you do. So if you're going to get started in this business, I have been privileged to mentor two businesses from before they started until recently when they sold their business, and another from when they were already in business. To try to let them grow, and unfortunately that scenario didn't work out so well. They're still struggling with their market and the customers' expectations and their expectations and things like that. But it's you know, be part of the industry. If you're going to do this, or if you're already doing it, get to the trade show. Meet the other contractors who are doing what you're doing. You know, when I am at home here in my market, my competing contractors and I are like Capulets and Montagues. You know, we circle each other, and I would take any opportunity I could to stick a sword in one of them. But at the trade show, it's all neutral ground. You can get your questions answered by people who aren't in your market. Questions on how to do this and how you handle that and what do you do about that from somebody who is 2,000 miles from where you are. And although it's a different geographical area and a different economic market, the problems are the same. The solutions are very similar. You know, you can't say, well, how do you sweep up sand if you're a New Jersey contractor to a guy who's from Minnesota? But you can ask that question of the guy from Arizona or some other place where they've got a lot of sand. I've gone to the trade shows where they ask people how they sweep up anti-skid, and they don't know what anti-skid is because it doesn't snow there. They're not putting grit on parking lots that they have to pick back up again. So not everything will be answered in detail or in specifics, and you know, and I don't believe anybody's going to tell you what they're pricing individual jobs at. But you're going to get a sense of what the market will be and what the market will bear. And if you go to the trade shows, if you interact with other contractors, if you take the opportunity to collect business cards and be friendly with those people and be receptive and be open to their questions, you will have a base of people to call on. I don't know everything there is to know about sweeping. There's still times I've got to call somebody and say, what am I going to do about this? And hopefully they've had the same experience. I've had, you know, handled lots of calls on what do you do about this? What equipment do you use? What do you do about this equipment? I've had people come here after we started buying the Victory Sweepers, and because we were closer than the factory, they came and demoed my equipment. I never followed up to see whether they bought the equipment or not. That's really not my concern. But I did follow up on how their business is going, what they sweep, how they're doing, you know, things like that. So it's I try to make as many friends with as many people in this industry and within allied industries as I possibly could. So the state of the industry is long-term prospects for any business at all are good. Any line of work that you can name, I certainly wouldn't want to be the buggy whip manufacturer, but any line of work that you can name, if there are people doing it now, there will be people doing it in 10 years. If there are people who are acting professionally in their line of work, there will be people who are there will always be room in the industry for people who act with professionalism. If you are not professional, don't wish to be professional, think you need to connive and cheat in order to get a profit out of your customers, this is not the business for you. It's just not the place to be. If you're marketing something that is supposed to be clean and it's not, it is completely evident to everybody that it's not. Not something you can hide.
That's for sure.
Being a painting contractor and being hired to paint a raw wall red and never going to do it and say, oh, yeah, I've done it, send me my money, and they go look and the wall's still blue. You know, it isn't, it's not the kind of industry that you can readily cheat people with. I would also have to say that long-term prospects, I'm very happy with the long-term prospects of this industry. I think we have here built a company that will move on to the next owner, the next generation, the next, you know, group. The benefit of being in this business as a maintenance company, as a shopping center maintenance company, is no matter what you build, no matter how long ago it was built, yesterday or 10 years ago, it has to be maintained. And if you own a shopping center, very few of my customers, if any, own the shopping center outright and don't hold a mortgage and don't owe somebody money. And if you owe somebody money, if you have a mortgage on that property, you're guaranteed that property is going to be inspected routinely by the people who you owe money to, who you're using that property as collateral, and you want them to find that property in a maintained state, fully leased, so that when you have to go back to them and borrow money, they know that the quality of your assets is good. And that thought process of making sure that your assets are good is why a company like ours can still exist. Because if you build it, you have to maintain it. There's just no way around it. This is not we're not maintaining steel mills in the Rust Belt where there's no point maintaining. There's nobody in them. The banks are foreclosed. The mills are out of business. The people are unemployed. This is retail. And the people do not want to be a tenant in the mall where people used to shop. They want to be a tenant in the mall where people still go. And even the oldest shopping center can be painted, seal-coated, striped, well-lit, clean, and still attract tenants and customers. Because when it was built there 10, 12, 15 years ago, 25 years ago, it was built there for a reason. They've never built a shopping center ever out of the way and then waited for suburban growth to catch up to it. They build them in the suburban areas, And the suburban area that was a suburban area when that Kmart shopping center was built 25 years ago, I guarantee you it's still a suburban area today. There are people still living in those houses. So those people still need to shop. And by keeping that shopping center clean and well-lit and painted and maintained and don't have cracks coming up, grass coming up through cracks in the sidewalk or the joint between the pavement and the curb and don't let the potholes be there, that will keep people from driving the extra 7 miles or 17 miles to the nicer Kmart down the road. They'll stay at the Kmart that's near their house. And then when they're at the Kmart, they'll go to the pizza place. They'll go to the, you know, the gym that's there. They'll go to the thrift store that's on the end. You know, whatever's in there. Because that's where they're going to go for Kmart. They'll notice what else is in there. And if the Kmart has survived all that time, you know, Kmart has faith in the plaza and in the place and in the property. So you got to make sure that the owner will, if you have an owner that will keep it up, that's how you make your money. Nobody makes money maintaining vacant shopping centers. Nobody makes money owning vacant shopping centers. That's why it has to be a collaborative effort between you, the vendor, and the customer that you have selected, whether the owner, the manager, whatever. You have to be an asset to them, because what you're doing is not an asset to them. That it's something they are forced to do. They understand they have to do it, and they have to do it. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to pay for parking lot sweeping. No part of the mall generates revenue less than the parking lot, but they're forced to maintain the parking lot. So you have to get past their mindset of you not being an asset, of you being a cure for a problem. You don't want to be a cure for a problem. You want to cure problems, but you don't want that to be your role. You want to be an asset. And if you can do that, if you can, you know, while we're talking about that kind of thing, years ago, oh man, I'm going to say 1985, 1988, I was at the trade show and ran into a guy who was in the seal coating business who had pay me, the words pay me, tattooed onto the palm of his right hand. And he made a huge deal about every job he got. He did, he got paid cash right then and there. Never had any bills, never had this, never had that. But, you know, he was not that far from me. And in going to look and see how he was doing that, because in 1985, I'm less than 10 years old. I'm amazed by how things are doing this. I'm amazed by somebody who sit there getting his palm tattooed.
I guess so, huh?
So I went and looked, and sure enough, he had two nice trucks. He had a nice house. He had a nice little business going of seal coat and things, but that's all he ever had. 10 years later, he wasn't there anymore. He was, you know, doing other things or whatever, because he did not build a business. He built himself a job. One of the recent exhibitors or presenters at the most recent NPE in Memphis was making a big presentation about, do you have a business? Have you built yourself a business or have you built yourself a job? Be aware of what you're building. Do you want to be the guy driving the sweeper, do 9 stops at night, 7 nights a week, make a good living or a reasonable living, be the only guy? You can do that if you want to. You know, you will never get rich in this business. You will never get rich working for yourself. The money is in having people work for you to be able to delegate the position of driver to another guy and go get that second truck. Sell that route full and put the driver in there and sell the third route full and go get that truck. Those are the things that you need. It's just like any other business, whether it's owning sub shops or whether dry cleaners or whatever. You know, we are not cabinet makers. The people around here who build cabinets make a nice living, sought after, have huge backlogs. One guy has a 2-year backlog. He wants kitchen cabinets, but he's the best there is, but it's him and the 2 people that help him in the shop, and that's it. He doesn't even install the stuff. He subs that out to people who install the stuff, but they are unbelievable cabinets. But when he dies, the business dies, because he's the cabinet maker. When I die, I'm kind of hoping this business continues on. There are you know, 54 people working here that rely on this business as the source of their family income. You know, it's not something you want to be haphazard about. I don't really know if that answers your question or not.
Well, I think it does. I think it answers it very well. And if you have infused in your team, which I'm sure that you have, the same kind of knowledge and let's just call it industry wisdom that you portray here in the interview, then I know that it will go on. And let's use that as a stopping point. I think the concept of building to the future so that you have a legacy and a financial stake to be able to pass on, not only for your inheritance as an inheritance, but also to your employees and the people that are counting on you when you're there in the business. If that can keep going, you know, what better legacy in the business world can there be? So let's close it there. Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Michael Nawa, and Michael is the Director of Operations and more at Custom Maintenance Services. His wife, Judy, is the president of that company, and she is also involved in the business. Together, they are a very powerful team in the Pennsylvania marketplace, and we are so proud to have them as our September 2012 featured contractor for World Sweeper. So thanks again, Michael, and I look forward to every time we talk, I learn something, and every time I see you, it brings a smile to my face. So
I appreciate that.
That's,
I assume I will see you in Nashville.
I'm sure we will.
Okay.
All right. Thank
Take
you.
Care, Ranger.